Okay, so I hope there are no technical problems, but yeah, we'll see how it goes. My computer has been erratic. Okay, so I'll be talking about 21 centimeter and in more general sense about realization, the cosmic dark ages, and how we can see them. And 21 centimeter, or redshifted 21 centimeter to be precise, is one of the most promising ways to do that. And before I start, there are a couple of very nice reviews if you want much more further detail. I'll put them at the end as well. So don't worry if you don't write everything down, that's fine. Okay, so obviously this is a bit less abstract than the previous lecture, much more yeah, cosmology, astrophysics, astrophysical cosmology type talk. And it will be just an overview. If you don't understand some details, don't worry. Just ask questions, and I can at least send you to some literature if I cannot answer it for some reason. Okay. So you must already know this, but just a reminder how the history of the universe goes and what are we going to talk about in this lecture. So you know that at the beginning there was the Big Bang, and this was sort of the topic up to now, early universe, inflation, quantum fluctuations. So we are not going to talk about this now. At some point the universe expanded enough and cooled down enough to actually decouple from the cosmic microwave background, and from there on they evolved separately. And so this is the age of decoupling. Is there a pointer?
Yellow.
Yes. Okay, so at some point there was the decoupling, and this is the era from which we are seeing the cosmic microwave background with satellites like Double Mouth and Earth-based telescopes. And later on, what happened is basically the matter just continued to cool down. It was already decoupled from the CMB, so they evolved different ways. The matter cools down much faster, following the matter equation of state, and the CMB follows the photon equation of state. So they have different temperatures, and the universe is nothing like the one we see today, because it's still very smooth, no structures, no stars, no galaxies, nothing has yet formed. So this is all happening something like 100 million years or so, a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. And at some point, the first nonlinear structures start forming with gravitational collapse. The small fluctuations that came from inflation started evolving, and slowly they collapse the structures. And you get the first galaxies, and then the first stars in them, first halos in galaxies. And once this formed, they start ionizing the material around them, start emitting ionizing radiation, and all the gas gets ionized eventually. So these are the cosmic dark ages, when there is no light, no stars, so that's why they are called like that. And the realization is done by the first stars, and eventually all the gas in the universe becomes ionized, and further down it's all ionized, and they are the usual galaxies that we see today at later times. And all this, which we'll talk about, happens in the first billion years or so of the evolution of the universe. And the realization is all done at about something like a billion years after the Big Bang. And the universe today is, of course, something close to 14 billion years or so. Okay, so what are these epochs and how are they defined? So realization is a global transition of the intergalactic medium from completely neutral after a combination and cool down to temperatures below the temperature for ionization, collision ionization. And this is done by the ionizing radiation from the first galaxies. And it ends by redshift 6 or so. And how do we know that? I'll show you in a moment. And this is a quite significant epoch because this is when the first structures form. The evolution is quite complex. You'll see in a moment again how we can simulate, model it. But it's also quite interesting because this is defining the early galaxy evolution and defining many of the things that happen later on, how the stars, what is the character of the star formation, galaxy formation later on. So it has significant effects on the subsequent galaxy formation. And one big problem which we are trying to solve now is there is very little observational data because this is so, so far away from us. In some sense, it's even worse than the cosmic microwave background because in this case, at least you can see it, and it's relatively linear, and then it's also relatively simple to see. But this is first of all nonlinear evolution, very far away, very high redshift, very difficult to see, low fluxes, and it's all mixed up with everything else that happens later on. So it is extremely difficult observation, and we have devised a number of ways to do that, but these are mostly still in the future. I'll show you what we know now and what is coming up in the near future, next few years, hopefully. So how do we know the universe is reionized today and has been for some time? The first very important probe is the structure of the IGM, basically. At low redshifts, in this case, redshift 2.5, there is a spectrum of a quasar. The quasar is here. This is the Lyman alpha line at some at the redshift of Lyman alpha line wavelength. And then in front of it, you see this something called Lyman alpha forest. A lot of the emission from the quasar comes through, basically, and it's mostly optically thin, which means that it's very, very highly ionized. Lyman alpha line is a resonance line, very high optical depth, so if you have even a little bit of neutral hydrogen, it becomes completely absorbed. So if anything comes through, and quite a bit comes through here, this means that everything is ionized to quite high level, something like 10^-4 or so. A neutral fraction. However, at high redshift, this changes. And there is one of the very famous observations from a few years back of one of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey quasars at redshift 6.2, one of the highest redshift quasars ever seen. And you see that the character of the spectrum is completely different. You still have the Lyman alpha line, but it is completely cut off on the blue side here, and there is basically no flux coming through on the blue side of the line, and there is only some coming through on the red side because this is lower frequency, so there is no resonance absorption in this case. So there is some of the line coming through, you can see it, but there is complete absorption in front, which means that it is more neutral than that. And this indicates that something must have happened between this time and this time. Obviously, here is highly ionized, here it starts to get a little bit neutral, and further out it is even more neutral. And at early times it must have been neutral because of it's cold and there is nothing to actually ionize it. So somehow around redshift 6 or a bit earlier, it went from completely neutral to completely ionized. And this is more detailed data from later times, last few years, and there are already a number of quasars you can see here. I don't, of course, expect to see anything in particular in detail from this spectra, but the point is that there is some flux transmitted at lower redshifts, 5.7 or so, and then as you go higher and higher, the Lyman alpha line, of course, moves to higher frequencies. What happens is that it becomes completely black in front of it, which means that you are seeing this absorption on the blue side of the line. And then this indicates there is some transition happening at around that time. Another indication that is relatively more recent is again from the WMAP satellite to look at some microwave background probe. And this is comes from when you measure from the spectrum of the CMB, you measure the correlations in the spectrum, the TT and TE correlations. And you see that there is some effect from ionization, which is there is significantly more optical depth scattering of on free electrons of the CMB photons on free electrons than we would expect if there was no ionization. So there is optical depth of something like 10% or 9%. Earlier it was actually measured to be higher, but then it was corrected. So this optical depth again indicates that there must have, something must have happened around redshift, relatively high redshift 10 or more, and the universe became ionized at that time, not later on. So these are basically the main probes we have right now about this epoch. And as you can see, there is not much, but we know that it happened. We know roughly when, and we have some idea that it has, must have been extended, because if it was very sharp at redshift 6, then the optical depth will be much lower than that. And starting from the beginning, how we can model this. Again, we start with the CMB. You see from the WMAP satellite, you see a picture of the whole sky, very small fluctuations in the CMB. These are fluctuations at level 10 to the minus 5 or so at most, and some are much lower than that. And this is just the imprint of this initial inflation fluctuations, which give the start of the, all the structures later on when they start forming. And from this, all the present-day universe evolves. And here is the spectrum of the fluctuations. So it looks something like this. This is wave number. So large scales are this way, small scales are this way. And we have many measurements. This is non-linear spectrum, so cosmic microwave background is linear. You can measure only the large scales. And then from other probes, you can measure also the spectrum at lower scales. But this is not so important here, but ionization is, depends on very small scales. This is one thing to take from here. Why is that? This is because structure formation in lambda CDM, the current model for the universe, structure formation is hierarchical, which means that the small structures form first, then the halos start merging, go up in scale, get bigger and bigger and bigger with time, until you get the present-day huge galaxy clusters and large-scale structures. So early times, the earlier you go, the smaller the structures are. So ionization is, of course, happening very early. So it is dictated by very small structures, smaller than even the stuff measured later on, for example, from the Lyman Alpha Forest. And you have heard about this last few days. So how does the universe look today? This is one example. There is a web of cosmic structures. Each of these yellow knots is a halo, and there are many halos, and they form some kind of honeycomb structure. So there are filaments and sheets, and all this structure is how the large-scale structure of the universe looks. So this is 500 megaparsecs across, if you want details, but that's not so important. In fact, cosmic cold dark matter is self-similar, so large scales and small scales look sort of the same, and the smaller scales you go, more or less it looks self-similar, so it looks exactly the same. You just need to zoom in, and it looks the same, more or less, until you go to really small scales, so that's another story. So this is a redshift zero, meaning the present, and you need some simulation of the structure formation to start first, or some model of it. Then at high redshift, the same thing looks a little bit different. Again, you see some beginning of the structures, and beginning of this honeycomb structure, but the structures are much less evolved. And they are again halos, but they are much smaller, so more difficult to see. And basically, earlier on, the gravitational collapse hasn't gone far enough yet, so the structures are not as evolved as later on. And this particular one is 100 megapascal box and 4.3 billion particle simulation, so one of the largest done. And it was done by our group, and this particular redshift is redshift 10, but of course it looks similar at all redshifts. So you need to know the structure formation at early times. And at smaller scales, how does things look? Is something like this. Again, you have filamentary structure, and at early times the fluctuations are linear. There are very, very little structure to be seen. This is only one megaparsec box here, and then later on you start seeing some structure, some small halos. And what's shown here is, I'll explain in a minute a bit more detail about the physics, but this is 21 centimeter emission, how it will be seen if we had a really good telescope for seeing the small scales. But for the moment, all that you need to see is that at small scales, the structures are much more evolved than at large scales. And in principle, it will be possible to see the cosmic dark ages even before realization to their 21 centimeter emission, which I'll explain. Yes?
I'm confused between the previous picture and the previous one. So the first one was simulation.
These are all simulations.
And what are simulations?
There are no observations here. So the difference between the pictures is that they're both at the same redshift. So what I was showing here, for example, is redshift 10, and before it was redshift 10 as well. However, this is much more evolved because we're zooming at very small scales, and structures form hierarchically. So small scales, the power on small scales is larger, as you saw in the power spectrum. So basically, the power spectrum of density fluctuations is, I can show. So this is how things look today. This is the power spectrum of density fluctuations. So what you need to notice is that there is different power at different scales. And so this is at present. But earlier on, the peak of the power spectrum actually moves at smaller scales. So you have more power at small scales early on, and the small scales start collapsing first. And then they start merging, and the long wavelengths collapse later because they have less power to begin with, so they need more time to be able to collapse. And that's why the difference between the pictures. So at late times, everything is already quite nonlinear. You see beautiful cosmic web of structures and all that. This is at present. So this could be compared with actual observational data from, for example, the Sloan survey or any other survey which people have done, of course. And they compare quite well. So we know that we can simulate structures with 10-body simulations, and they represent the real universe fairly well. At earlier times, however, things are much less evolved. This is a smaller scale already than the previous one. However, it's still quite less evolved because these are still modes that are relatively linear. And so they haven't formed any structure. There are no filaments. I mean, there are a little bit of filaments like this, but there are no clusters yet, no very large galaxies. There are only tiny little galaxies, which you can barely see on this picture. And then you go to smaller scales at the same time, and then you see that there are really these tiny little galaxies that are in filamentary structure. So small scales at early times look like the large scales at late times. But at late times, the large scale managed to evolve enough to actually look similar to the small scales. Otherwise, once you zoom, they don't look similar. You get the same web of structures and the same halos at the nodes of the web and all that. So that's the only difference. Structures evolve differently depending on the scale and the time. to different speed. Okay, so what else is important in terms of physics, how we can understand these early epochs? Basically, there should be some sources for this ionization. The sources of ionizing radiation that ionizes all the gas in the universe eventually. And what could the sources be? So first of all, most obviously, there are stars. In the galaxies, there are many stars that form. These stars emit ionizing radiation. And so there is, presumably, there is enough of them. We can actually measure it. And it looks like there is enough stars to actually ionize the universe. You can also assume that some of the radiation comes from quasars, so accreting black holes, which also emit ionizing radiation. It's a different kind of spectrum of radiation and all that, but at the end there is quite a bit of ionizing radiation coming out. However, once you start counting the quasars, we can see a higher redshift. There seem to be too few of them. There is a peak of the quasars, which peaks something like redshift 2 or 3, and then at high redshift, they just peter out, and there is not enough of them to actually ionize the universe. You can assume that there are some more exotic sources, like mini quasars, very tiny little ones, but there is not much evidence for that. Actually, it even may contradict some of the observations, so it's not obvious they could be a viable source. And there are also some exotic sources, which are like particle decay, for example. You get some sort of particle at high redshift, which decays, emits ionizing radiation, and ionizes the universe, or at least partially ionizes the universe. That's, of course, a possibility. It cannot be excluded at the moment, but it's somewhat speculative because, it's not clear, is there such a particle, does it have the right properties and all that. So this is unclear. It's still a possibility. The quasars probably contribute some part of the ionization, but not enough to actually do it. And the main possibility is stellar radiation for the moment. And more specifically, stars which are forming in atomically cooling halos. What does this mean? So relatively large halos. What does this atomically cooling halos mean? You need to know a little bit about the cooling of gas at these temperatures. So the gas cooling, there are two basic types. So first of all, the gases consist mostly of hydrogen and helium early on. There are still no heavy elements. There are no all this complicated chemistry that people can see later on, because heavy elements are made in stars. And since the stars haven't been created yet, or there have been only little, small number of stars, they and the metals, or heavier elements, astronomers tend to call them metals, haven't been distributed uniformly. So most of the primordial chemistry is pristine gas coming from the Big Bang. So mostly hydrogen and helium, and a little bit of other elements. And how do gas consisting of mostly hydrogen and helium cool? If it is above 10,000 degrees or so, it can cool through atomic lines, basically. So these are the hydrogen and helium atomic lines, and at higher temperature, there is other process like thermal Bremsstrahlung and other kinds of counter scattering and so on. But at low temperatures, the main coolant is line radiation. So basically, you excite lines, and then the radiation gets emitted back, and you cool the gas. At lower temperatures, this is not very feasible, because you see that the cooling function cuts off completely, very exponentially. So what happens at low temperatures is you need H2 molecules to cool it. An H2 molecule's cooling function looks something like this. So it is not very efficient at high temperatures, and these molecules get destroyed anyway. However, at small temperatures, this is the only option. Unless they are heavier elements, the H2 molecules are the only coolant available. And there are some also other molecules like HD and a few other things, but the main coolant is hydrogen molecules. Rotational and vibrational modes of hydrogen molecules. And to be able to form stars, you need to be able to cool the gas to relatively low temperatures. Otherwise, stars will never form. They just cannot collapse. To be able to form a star, you need the gas to be the gas pressure to not counteract the gravity. And the gas pressure is low enough only if the gas is very, very cool. If it's not cool enough, you cannot form stars. You can only form much bigger things, like galaxies, chaos. So you need to cool the gas below 10,000 first, and then down to a few hundred degrees with H2 molecules until you are finally able to form stars. So cooling is extremely important, and these are the only mechanisms at high redshift. At low redshift, you can cool also through Kepler elements, and this is much more efficient than this. So atomically cooling halos means halos that have temperature, virial temperature after virialization, above 10,000 degrees, so they can cool through this very efficient atomic cooling. Smaller halos have lower temperatures, and that's why they can only cool with H2 molecules. So early star formation, the very first stars form in very small halos. And these small halos have very low temperatures, so they can only cool through hydrogen molecule cooling, just because the gas is already below 10,000 degrees, so they cannot cool further through atomic line cooling. And so the gas in the protogalaxies has typically starts with the halo virial temperature, which is just the temperature it got when the halo collapsed and virialized. So all the kinetic energy of the collapse goes into internal energy of the halo, and this is called virial energy. And there is a virial temperature which corresponds to it. So if the mass of the halo is relatively large, above 10 to the 8 or so solar masses, the virial temperature is about 10,000 degrees, and atomic cooling is efficient. Below that, you need H2 molecules. So that's one important thing to remember in terms of primordial chemistry. Another complication is that H2 molecules are relatively easily destroyed. If you have any kind of UV radiation, even not ionizing, but just UV radiation below the ionizing radiation, so longer wavelength, which can travel very far, you still can destroy all the molecules relatively easily and not form them that easily, which means that the first stars form and they destroy the molecules and most probably spoil it for everybody else for a while, which means that most of the stars only form relatively later when the halos become larger. And that's why the main contributors to ionization are expected to be relatively large halos of 10 to the 8 solar masses or above. Now, in terms of present-day galaxies, these are still very, very, very tiny halos. The smallest galaxies we see today are of that size or quite a bit larger even. And but still, at early times, these are the top dots. There are no bigger ones, so this is all there is. Small halos, and they have to do everything. Another bit of physics that you need to be able to understand ionization is how ionization propagates. So UV photons from hot stars ionizing their surroundings and create so-called H2 regions, which are ionized regions around them. And the speed of growth of these regions, or the propagation of ionization front, is determined by two things. First of all, the number of photons coming from the star, minus the number of recombinations that happen in already ionized regions. Because if the gas recombines, you need to ionize it again to be able to propagate further, to keep it ionized. Which means that you have a photon balance. Number of photons coming in should balance the combination and the new atoms that get into the ionized region. And so for constant density, you have some solution, which basically is something called the jump condition. So ionization front basically propagate based on very simple condition. Velocity of ionization front is the flux of photons divided by the number of density of atoms. Can get simpler than that. This just means that when you have the front, there are some photons coming in, there are some atoms coming in from the other side edge, or helium atoms, and the front only goes forward when the photons balance the atoms coming in. So once you balance this, you get the speed of the ionization front, like the flux divided by the number of density of atoms coming into the front. Of course, once you have density homogeneities, things get a bit more complicated. And this is one nice picture of what happens nowadays. This is actual observations. In this case, the Tripped Nebula. There is a hot star in the middle and the ionization region around it. And you can see that they're different wavelengths, so that's why the nice colors. Of course, as most pictures, nice pictures you see, these are not actual colors. If you just look at the nebula, you won't see that. These are fake colors indicating certain lines that are seen by the telescopes. But still, it is quite a nice picture. We know a lot more about lower redshift stuff than the high redshift. But still, it helps to understand things. Okay, so when the speed of the front falls below a certain level, which is about twice the sound speed of the gas, then the gas will start to respond hydrodynamically, which means that things get suddenly more complicated. Initially, ionization fronts propagate very fast. You just flush ionize everything, the gas cannot respond, the front propagates very quickly, and the gas doesn't move anywhere. So it just gets ionized, and that's it. And this is called R-type front, or rarefied. However, once the front slows down enough to actually the gas to be able to respond hydrodynamically, then you get something called D-type front, or density. And then things get much more complicated, because then you have to account for gas dynamics and other complications. And also, of course, real H2 regions do not grow at constant density, so you need to calculate what is the density and account for the inhomogeneities, different directions is different. And basically, theoreticians tend to look, at least when you don't do simulations, at H2 regions like spherical chaos, because this is easier. However, real nebulae, as you saw before, don't look anything like this. They are rather messier. And that's why usually you need simulations if you want to get the details, but you can do quite a bit also analytically if you do it properly. And these are a lot of complicated formulae. Don't worry if you don't understand all the details. There is no rush for that. This is the main point that you want to get from this is that cosmological ionization fronts are somewhat different from the ionization fronts that I just showed you, from the stellar ones at low redshift in dense media. Cosmological ionization fronts are different because the universe is expanding all the time. So as the ionization front propagates, the density continually goes down as time goes, which means that the ionization front doesn't really slow down that quickly. If you have a constant density, it's one thing. But if that density constantly goes down, this means that it gets easier and easier for it to propagate forward. And once you write down all the details, and there is some equation for its propagation, and you can solve this equation analytically, assuming the spherical Kao approximation, then at the end, what you get is that all cosmological ionization fronts, almost without exception, are R-type fronts, which means the simple kind. They are just propagating very quickly, the gas doesn't move anywhere, and we can actually describe them without following the gas dynamics. And that's the only thing that you need to get from all these complicated formulae. If you want more detail, then you can read the paper. It's quite a nice classic paper from some time ago. But the bottom line for here is that they are relatively simple R-type, which means no gas dynamics. They just propagate very fast and ionize the universe eventually. So once you start simulating this, this is how it looks. You have the initial, the galaxies are the tiny black dots here. and they are following the cosmic web, so they are very highly clustered in knots and along the filaments. And then the ionized regions are the reddish yellow things, and the cosmic web is shown in green, the density field. And then you see that this very complicated web of structures forms until everything gets ionized. And then the question is how we can see this bubbly structure, how we can see this neutral and ionized patchy regions. And this is the main point of the talk, the lecture. So one last complication, I'll just mention it because we don't have much time, but there are things like, for example, genes mass filtering, other complications which make things difficult to describe. Basically, what genes mass filtering means is very relatively simple. When you ionize the gas, you also heat it. If you heat it to 10,000 degrees, this means its pressure rises. And once the pressure rises, this means it's more difficult to counteract, it's more easy to counteract the gravity, which means that only bigger things can collapse. You just rise the genes mass. The genes mass shows which mass can collapse, is large enough to collapse, so that the gravity is stronger than the pressure forces. And if you rise the temperature, you rise the pressure, then you need more mass to actually be able to collapse. Which means that in the ionized and heated regions, only relatively large galaxies collapse, while in the small ones, you can collapse. In the neutral regions, you can collapse smaller galaxies. And this has important implications, which I cannot go into right now, but ask me if you have questions. Something called self-regulation of the ionization, which basically means that it's not very important what the efficiency of the small sources is. And once you account for that, you can also do a simulation, and then it looks somewhat different from before. Some of the sources appear and disappear because of this filtering. Basically, you suppress their formation. They cannot form stars anymore once they are in ionized regions, so the character of ionization changes somewhat, especially at the beginning. Okay, what are the main results? There are several things just to take from this. First of all, ionization proceeds inside out. What does this mean is that you start from the densest points, because this is where the sources form, this is where the galaxies form. They form at the density peaks, the densest points in the universe, and then you propagate the ionization from south, which means that first you ionize the densest points in the universe, and then you ionize the lower density points. It's also very highly patchy. You saw this very complex topology and geometry of ionization, so it is complicated. There is a characteristic scale which could be derived from these simulations or some analytical models. It's also self-regulated, as I mentioned. And small box simulations are not actually large enough to simulate ionization. I cannot go into details for this. But basically, when you simulate two smaller boxes, then you don't account for the large wavelength modes, which means that you're getting the character incorrect. So there are problems there. And just to tell you that we don't know everything, at small scales, things are much messier. There are many small halos and complicated structures, which I showed at the beginning. And if you account for this, of course, things get a lot more complicated, and we still haven't done this. We can do it at very small scales, we see what happens, but this is just one cell in the big simulation, so to be able to see this requires much bigger dynamic range than we currently have, and there is a lot of things to be done in the future. How we can see ionization? The last thing, and actually the main point of this talk. There are a number of ways people have devised, and I'll probably just mention the first one, which was the main topic of this, which is redshift at 21 centimeter. There is also a small scale CMB fluctuations through kinetic synergy and Dolich effect, CMB polarization signature, and you can also observe high redshift 1 and alpha sources. Okay, what 21 centimeter is? Basically, the They are radio waves. Hydrogen atoms in the early universe can be detected either in absorption or emission against the cosmic microwave background. And this happens at the redshifted radio wavelength of 21 centimeter. Once you redshift it from very high redshift, it's actually the meter wavelength. So roughly speaking, the TV and the radio bands. So this makes it more complicated. Halos that form during these dark ages are quite dense and hot enough to appear in emission, which I'll again mention in a moment. The intergalactic medium can appear either in emission or absorption. So how does the 21 centimeter work? It's very simple atomic physics. Basically, a hydrogen atom has a nucleus in the middle, electron, and the spins of the nucleus and electron could be either aligned or opposite. And going from one to the other, there is a little bit of difference in the energy levels. And this difference is actually corresponds to the photon of wavelength 21 centimeter. So basically, once you flip the spin of the electron, you emit or absorb 21 centimeter photon. And the frequency is easy to get, it's 1.42 gigahertz frequency. And this causes transition from one to the other and back. And there are several things that could happen. First of all, there is something called spin temperature, which just shows what is the level population of the two levels. So how many atoms you have in the high level or the low level. And this, if this temperature is larger than the CMB, so if the gas is hotter than the CMB at that time, then you see it in emission. If it's cooler than the CMB, you see it in absorption. And if it's exactly equal to the CMB, it's transparent, there is no spin flip transition, you don't see anything. And the other thing that you need to be able to see 21 centimeter is to be able to change the level population, you need to either absorb 21 centimeter photon from the CMB. You have to collide with another atom, hydrogen atom, or absorb the UV photon at the 12-15 angstrom to make one alpha transition. So these are called pumping of the line, so you want to get the level population to be off equilibrium to be able to see anything. Otherwise it's in equilibrium, you don't see anything. And how does the evolution work from high redshift? Initially everything is coupled. So the photons are coupled to the matter, and the spin temperature is coupled to the CMB, and everything is goes together and you don't see anything. Then as the temperature cools down, then the photons actually start decoupling from the CMB, and then you start seeing first absorption because the gas is very cold, and then later on you see largely emission, especially inside the halos. Once realization starts, then you start seeing emission inside the halos and generally emission also outside because you have a lot of Lyman alpha photons coming out of the stars and this manages to decouple everything from the CMB and you start seeing all the neutral patches emit and you get this signal from on the sky. Or at least we hope you do because nobody has seen it yet. And there are several types of signals that you can get. One that should be, in some sense, easiest to see is so-called global step. Basically, what global step means is very simple. At high redshift, everything is neutral. At low redshift, everything is ionized. When the gas is ionized, it doesn't emit at 21 centimeters because there is no level population. It's ionized. There are no hydrogen atoms. They are all just electrons and protons. At high redshift, everything is neutral, so you get this transition from everything emitting at 21 centimeter to everything neutral and not emitting. And depending on how fast this transition is, it could be easier or relatively difficult to see. If the transition is fast, this means that there is an all sky signal. So all the sky, suddenly the signal at higher frequencies exists, at low frequencies it doesn't. And then there is a drop in the signal at some frequency, and this indicates ionization. In practice, these are simulation results. Here you see that it's actually relatively smooth. So everything happens in this case around 140 to 120 megahertz. So the transition happens over something like 20 megahertz and drops, the signal drops by 20 millikelvin or so. So this could be possible to see, but it is difficult and still hasn't been done. What else can we do? So basically, once you start constructing the signal, there are two ways you can go. So this is the image cube. So on the sky, you have two angles. So just the angles on the sky. And then you have redshift in this direction. So the time, of course, goes earlier is high redshift, and later is low redshift. So it goes the opposite way. And the frequency, of course, changes with redshift again. So you have the redshift direction is just frequency space, and then on the sky you have some angular directions. So you can cut the image cube this way, which means you pick a single frequency and you try to image the sky. Or you can cut it the other way, and so this is what happens in this case. You get the initial distribution of neutral, green, and ionized blue. Then this corresponds to some fluctuations in the temperature of this 21 centimeters. And then this, once you smooth it with some beam with actual telescope sort of parameters, then you get a somewhat smoother picture, but you still see the main structure. So in principle, it should be possible to see. So all the main neutral patches, for example, you still see here. And the ionized are, of course, black because there is no 21 centimeter coming out of them. But this is a difficult experiment. Then the other option is you cut it the other way. So you cut it along redshift and you try to see what is the evolution with redshift. So not try to image it on the sky, but actually cut it in slices in redshift and try to see the evolution along that direction. And this is what simulations give. So from high redshift, you have sort of the light here is neutral, the dark is ionized, and you get this patchy evolution as the things get more and more ionized versus frequency. And once you smooth it, so it looks like something more like what real radio telescopes will see, then you get all the main structures are actually still present. You lose some small scale stuff, but basically you can see all the evolution. And you can see a lot of fluctuations until they disappear once everything gets ionized. And in principle, it could be possible to see with near future radio telescopes, but it will be a difficult experiment. Let's see if this will work. So this is a small movie, if it shows. Projector. Okay, so the radio telescopes that will be able to see it, hopefully, there's already either constructed, this is giant meter-wave radio telescope in India, one of the antennas, and these are huge antennas, 40 meters across, and there are, I think, 16 of those. And then there is another one which looks much less impressive, but these are basically a bit more complicated TV antennas, roughly speaking. And there are many, many of them. So this is a schematic of it. The dark thing here is all of Holland. So it's being constructed in Holland. And as you can see, it's quite large. And there are stations all over Europe and most of Holland, and then stretching out to Germany and UK and all over the place. So this goes for hundreds of kilometers. And all these stations are connected. There is a large supercomputer in the middle which collects all the data and reduces it. Some of the data is reduced at the station, some of it, and then it's sent to the central one. And these are interferometers in the sense that they measure differences between what one antenna sees and what the other antenna sees, and try to subtract this to get some fluctuation signal from the sky. And the future is actually yet bigger telescope, which is called Square Kilometer Array, and it will be constructed in something like 10 years or so, maybe a bit less, in either South Africa or Australia. And this is one possibility how it will look. It's not quite yet clear even how it will look, but basically the idea is it has collecting area for roughly speaking a square kilometer, so it will be a huge telescope, the largest ever constructed, and it will be very exciting for many years, and it will be collecting a lot of wonderful data, one of which will be redshift 21 centimeter. So we are hoping that this will happen within something like 5 to 10 years, but it's still in the being in the projecting stage. So the experiment, I won't go into detail too much detail, but basically one thing to remember, it's a detail, but very important detail, there are a lot of things that can mess things up. Basically, when you look at the sky in radio, what happens is that there is a lot of emission from synchrotron radiation from the galaxy, for example. So the galaxy, our own galaxy, the Milky Way, has magnetic fields. Electrons rotate in these magnetic fields, emit synchrotron radiation. And this synchrotron radiation at low radio frequencies is hugely powerful. So basically, it is something like 110 to 100,000 times more powerful than the signal that we are trying to see. And it is everywhere, of course, because we are inside the galaxy, so we cannot really get rid of it very easily. You cannot, for example, by pointing some direction that it doesn't exist because it's everywhere. So you need to subtract it somehow, and there are a lot of complications. But people are working on trying to solve those. Then there are also radio galaxy, radio halos and relics, extragalactic free pre-emission from electrons. And all these are in tens to kelvins to tens to hundreds of kelvins, and the emission we are trying to see is millikelvins, tens of millikelvins. So obviously there is many orders of magnitude difference, and this will be quite complicated experiment. And a lot of people are working on trying to solve these problems. There are just a few more minutes, so I'll just give you a brief flavor of the other possibilities, how you can see ionization. One possibility is so-called kinetic Sinyaris-Ludovic effect. What this is basically when you have free electrons, and CMB photons can backscatter from it through quantum scattering, and then it can either gain some energy or lose some energy, depending on which way it scatters. And then you get fluctuations. So the CMB photons go through all the structures with free electrons. And when they get scattered, you can get either get a bit lower temperature or a bit higher temperature, and you get fluctuations in the temperature of the CMB. If you have a linear density fluctuations, this is called the Ostreicher-Wisniewski effect. Non-linear density fluctuations, it's kinetic Sinyaris-Ludovic in a bit more narrow sense. And the first order of, once you calculate it carefully, the first orders or the biggest fluctuations actually cancel. And the reason is basically geometric. All the structures more or less collapse in all directions. So the photons go into the potential well and then come out on the other side. So they gain some energy, then lose some energy. And essentially, at the end, the first approximation, they don't gain or lose anything. But once you start calculating it a bit more complicated, more detailed way, you see that there is second order effect, which actually gives you some effect. And there are, again, several of these. Some come from clusters of galaxies at low redshift, and then some comes from the patch ionization, because, of course, during ionization you have free electrons. The free electrons scatter photons, and again you get some signal like that. How does the signal, is the signal calculated? So basically the temperature fluctuations compared to the CMB temperature in units of the CMB temperature are just line of sight integral along the and this is the Thomson scattering cross section. Then this is the conformal line, conformal time. the optical depth to scattering, and the velocity along the line of sight projection, and the expansion factor of the universe, and the electron density. So you do these lines of sight, line of sight integrals, and then you can calculate the differences between one and another line of sight, and you get some fluctuations. So you can do this, and there are some details which are more technical, I won't go into. The telescopes that can see this actually are already in existence from a few months ago. So there are two telescopes like that. One is called the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and it is, as the name shows, in Atacama Desert in Chile. Here it's shown on the track when it goes to the side. This was from March this year. And now it's already in place and being already starting to collect data. And this is before that it has been constructed here in Canada, in Vancouver. The other telescope is called South Pole Telescope, and it is already again in operation on the South Pole in Antarctica. And both the places are probably the best places you can put such a telescope, because first of all you need little water in the air, water vapors, and second you need preferably cold place, because these are essentially working by getting the CMB photons to heat some their colorimeters. So once CMB photon hits, they create some, give some energy to the detector, and then you can detect something. And water vapor also messes things up quite significantly. So they are both in cold and dry places, and probably the two most cold and dry places in the world are Atacama and South Pole, Antarctica. That's why the eggs are there. And you can calculate, for example, power spectrum on the sky that's coming from ionization. And these are the sensitivities of those telescopes. This is the South Pole telescope, the Atacama one. And in both cases, in principle, you should be able to see, assuming that you can actually separate the signal from all the other signals that are mixed with it, which again is very complicated, but people are working on it, our group included. And these are some results that we have gotten, but there are also other signals you can see. This is the primary CMB signal, CMB fluctuations. This is the signal that comes from after ionization, from clusters and other structures once the universe is ionized. And this is the signal coming from ionization. So you see that it's not trivial, but it's also a bit lower than the other signals. So, and they have the same spectrum, which is just black body spectrum, so it's difficult to distinguish. And the very last thing I'll mention is the CMB polarization signature. Basically, again, it's based on scattering. You have three electrons, photons scatter on them, and then you get slight polarization of the CMB, and which is on top of any polarization that you may have to begin with, coming from other things before the universe. And because of fluctuations in the optical depth along line of sight on the sky, then you get this polarization from one place to another. There is slight differences in the polarization, and you can get polarization maps. So this is even more difficult than anything else up to that I mentioned up to here. More difficult to observe, but it's a possibility for the future. Maybe one of you could work on this. But at least we have some idea about the level of the signal now, and there is such a signal. And it's one of the actually two dominant signals. The other is lensing, which you'll hear about this afternoon, which gives polarization signal of the CMB. And that's it. Any questions? I hope I do go too fast, but yeah, feel free to ask any questions. I'll be here all day in case you have something else comes up. But yes.
Do you expect also interference from the television and
the from? Yes, it's a huge problem. So there are basically several ways to deal with that. One way is to just do the experiment in a place which doesn't have television, which are not many on Earth nowadays, but as it happens, for example, India is a good place, because we found out that during the night in India there is no TV. So at least half a day you can observe without being interfered. Obviously, this is not the case with Europe, so telescope, the LOFAR telescope that's in Europe will have this problem. So the best hope there is to basically observe in bands that are not in the TV and try to cut out the TV bands. So you just, so radio, FM radio, for example, is from roughly 9 to 10 megahertz, and you just don't observe there and hope that the interesting signal isn't there. Essentially, that's the best you can do. There are also other problems. For example, digital TV is even worse because it's very wide band, so it is not particular frequencies, but it's sort of wide in frequency, and then I'm not even sure how they'll deal with that, but I'm not really an observer. The other option is, again, to go someplace which doesn't have TV, like Australia. Western Australia is another experiment. In China, there is one experiment. There are places where you can do that, quite remote and with mountains around, things like that. But it's always a problem, more or less. You have to be careful with that. Other questions? Okay, well, if something comes up, I'll be here until tonight. So thank you for your attention.